Our special guest tonight, Dr. Brian Weiss, as we talk about past life therapy and regression. And we'll have more to come on Coast to Coast AM. Brian, do you think we can go into the future to look at future lives?
I do. I've been studying this for some time also. I got interested in looking into the future through people who were having precognitive dreams. That is, in their nighttime dreams, they would dream of future events, and then these events would often come true. And I found that people who have had near-death experiences, they become even more proficient at having these precognitive dreams. And I thought, if people can dream about the future in their nighttime dreams, perhaps if I'm using hypnosis or these deeper states of focus and concentration, I can also take them into the future. And it turns out that you can do this. It's not as easy as going into the past, but it's possible. And people have been able to actually win lotteries. That's not the purpose for doing it, but it has happened several times already. And see future events. It's not impossible to do that. I call it progression. Instead of regression going backwards, just progression going into the future.
Going into the future, how far do you think you can go? Way, way out?
Absolutely. I was doing a study one time with groups because I got interested in, you know, what you're going to, I'm sure, focus a lot on the 2012 and all of these things that are coming up. And I wanted to know, well, if I bring large groups of people into the future, say I'm working with 800 people or 1,000 people, and two-thirds or three-quarters are hypnotized, then I have them fill out a questionnaire at the end. I was doing this for several years. And they would indicate, you know, I took just three time periods. I wanted to focus on the near future, about 150 to 200 years out, then the middle future or intermediate future, about 500 or 600 years out, and then a far future, more than 1,000 years. And I wanted to see if when they filled these things out, there was some sort of consensus or commonality or correlation. That is, did a lot of people in one of these three future times describe the same thing? And I found out, yes, people were doing that, especially in the far future, the one that is 1,000 years or more. And they were describing a planet that's still here, the Earth, very green, very fertile, but the population of humans had declined drastically. People were happy. There was no more illness, no wars. People could communicate telepathically. It was very advanced in that sense, but the population had been reduced. And I got the consensus from the middle time that something in that time period had happened, but that it's not entirely fixed yet. And that goes along with modern physics in the sense that there is probably an infinity of futures, since there is an infinity of universes, and that the future that actually comes to be, the consensus future, will be determined sort of by the consciousness of the beings on the planet. So it may not be fixed. So we can get to a smaller population in a peaceful way, such as, for example, a conscious decline in having babies or a decline in the fertility rate, not as peaceful, but maybe from toxic reasons. The worst would be wars or that kind of
Or intentional sterilization and things like that.
Yes, exactly. But it comes about. The consensus was there that the population is much reduced, but the Earth is sort of idyllic, but the middle period is tough. And the near future, the consensus was that it's more of the same, more wars, pollution, et cetera. Science advances, but so do the other things. But we're still here. We don't just disappear.
Get this, Brian. Here in St. Louis, it's now 11:11, and the time was just 1:11 just a few minutes ago.
Okay.
I see those numbers all the time. I can't get away from them.
Yeah, they're telling us there's something coming, and we should shift our consciousness. But your show does that. You have people, and I know this book that you were describing, your book, that, you know, the people listening to your show, they have marvelous experiences, and they progress spiritually, and this may be what's necessary as we come into this future.
Why do we reincarnate at all?
My thinking is that we reincarnate in order to learn our lessons here, that it takes more than one life to learn these lessons, that the lessons are not mysterious. They're lessons about love and forgiveness and nonviolence and patience and kindness, compassion, these things. But we don't We don't learn that easily. We're a stubborn species. And so as most of the world believes in reincarnation, the consensus is that we come back to learn, that this is a big school, and that we learn about these things. And we develop what are called debts or karma. This is not an Eastern concept. It's all religions. That is, what you sow, that's what you reap. What you do has consequences, all of your acts and actions. And so you have to deal with that. So if you've harmed someone in a past life, you need to make it up to them. You have to learn about kindness, compassion, that we're all the same, that we have to stop this insane aggression and warfare and violence and prejudice. It needs to stop. Otherwise, the population is going to go down in the, what I would say is the tragic way or the violent way. But if we can somehow stop doing these things to each other, if we can somehow recognize the commonality that we all have, that we're all people, we're all really souls. It's not just our bodies that are important, it's the souls. And the souls don't have sex or race or religion or nationality. We're all the same. We have to stop hating and warring and being aggressive and become more compassionate. This is the ultimate goal, but that seems to take many lifetimes to learn these lessons.
I think so, too. And I think one of the problems, so many people on this planet, though I think most are good people, those in power generally may not be. And, you know, those are the ones that need to go through 100 more past life regressions, I think.
I think so. The race is on. You know, it's a race between the technology and the people in power who can use technology in a malignant way. And the other side is the more spiritual, more compassionate side. And we have to make sure that our leaders are at least aware of this at some level. It's difficult.
I was raised a Catholic. But for some reason, Brian, at a very young age, I believed in reincarnation. I don't know why. For some reason, I believed that we would come back to reach perfection, to get to this heaven state. And if it took two lives or 50 lives, we'd keep coming back until we got better. So I would walk around and I would see people, kids in school, for example, who were fun and friendly and nice. And at a very young age, I would say to myself, that person's progressed. That person's come back enough where they're getting close. I don't know how many more human lives they have, but they're getting close where they're not going to reincarnate anymore. And then I would see other kids like bullies and mean kids and stuff. And I'd say, you know, that kid's a Neanderthal. He's going to have to come back, you know, more times. Why at that young age do you think I even thought that, and how close am I to the possibility of that being fact?
I think you're very close. That's really the way that it works, and that you can see the difference in progression of the souls here. Some are really seemingly advanced. They're more compassionate, more kind. They know these things, and some are like first graders. They're still banging around in a violent way, and I think you knew that when you were younger. And by the way, the largest library of reincarnational materials in the Western world is in the Vatican. This has been around for a long, long time. And so there are many religious supports to this. But you knew when you were younger, you knew that. And that turns out to be actually the way that it does work. You were aware of that. So the intellectual stuff that comes later, that overlay of ritual and dogma and whatever else, that's not as pure and clear as the instinctual knowledge that children have. And you had that. You knew. That is the way that it works, George. I think you're very accurate when you were having those feelings as a child.
And and someone like Jesus was already at perfection, for example.
Right.
I don't know how many times, this is difficult, but, you know, did his soul come back many times before it reached this level of perfection? Or was it perfect from the get-go? That's the big question there. I don't know.
I don't know either. I'm not a theologian. There are people who think that he may have reincarnated as say, a Buddha before.
Buddha.
Who lived 500 years before that and changed the world with. And maybe that is the same soul. I don't know this. But clearly, both of those reincarnated voluntarily. They had reached such a profound level that they did not have to come here, but they came back voluntarily to help humankind. And
do you think all souls reincarnate?
I do.
Generally?
I do. I think that all souls reincarnate, but you can graduate, and then you don't have to come here. And this is not the only school. There are advanced schools. Maybe, you know, when people die sometimes or they have near-death experiences, as the near-death experiences, obviously they return and they can talk about their experiences, but they often describe a level above this where there is no violence and people can communicate through thought and there's no illness anymore, no disease, and you don't need your physical body as much, but maybe a lighter body or an etheric body or something like that. I think there are worlds like this. They're like, if we're in the 10th grade, that's the 12th grade or college. And so you don't always have to come back here. You will be reincarnating somewhere, though.
The reincarnation in terms of speed, you know, because we talk about ghosts, we talk about spirits on this planet. They're wandering around.
Right.
How soon generally after someone dies does a soul burst away and then come back again, reincarnated?
It can be very fast. It can be within a day. Or it can be longer than a century, because there's no time on the other side, I don't think. They're not just there twiddling their thumbs. But the situation is set up for the soul to learn. So, for example, say that you're going to come back with your child, but it's going to be in an equal relationship. You're going to be best friends or something like that. You've got to wait for them to live out their life, too. So it can be one day or it can be more than a century. It depends on the needs of the soul, what it needs to learn, what the lessons are, and with whom they are coming back, because we seem to come back again and again with many of the same people, the same souls. The relationship can change. Your grandmother may come back as your son, but the souls are the same.
The souls are the same.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Is the loved one who comes back when they die, to either convince the person who's alive that they're okay or there's some connection there. They tend to wait, though, before they move on, don't they? There's a reason.
Yes, often their reason is to help us from the other side, whatever you want to call them. I think that's where the term guardian angels came from, but some people call them guides or spiritual guides or whatever, but they're loved ones who have died, and they're helping from the other side, and I find this all the time. I've done a lot of work also studying the minds of mediums, because as a psychiatrist, I'm interested in how people do this. How does the mind work? You know, how can they get this sort of detailed information, having never met the person before? And it's really dramatic when that happens. So I think their job then is to help us, just as perhaps before our birth, we were helping them from the other side. And they may not need to come back right away. Maybe they can just linger till we cross over. And what I often find in studying near-death experiences, and I've done this with Raymond Moody and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and others who have pioneered the near-death experience, Melvin Morse and many others, they often are met by a spiritual figure or a loved one, a grandmother, a mother who is already passed over, and they greet you to help you with your own transition. It's really not such a terrible thing. It's very, very good to see them again and to be reunited and to be in a place where there is no pain and no illness and no misery. This is the difficult place to me. That's what I keep finding. Earth. Here, we have physical bodies. We have pain, loss, illness, death, disease. It's a very, very hard school, but on the other side, it's much easier.
Is there like a hall of souls where they just all sit up there?
I don't know. Some people write about these things, you know, and they've written books about these things. I find people more, souls more drawn into the light. And not, you can be in a hall if you want to, I think, but it's not necessary. You're drawn into a light. There are many other souls around you. What you think exists. So if you think you need food, there'll be food there. But as you realize you don't need food because you don't have a physical body anymore, then the food sort of just fades away and you don't need it. So if you want it to be a hall, fine. If you want there to be schools, fine. They'll be there. The main thing is that the soul goes on. You don't die when your physical body dies. And your consciousness, your soul goes on, is reunited with loved ones. And I'm not just saying that because it makes people feel better. This has been described to me thousands and thousands of times in my patients and in others. And people just, you know, I guess because of the all the books I've written and whatever recognition has come, I get to be sort of a clearinghouse for the weird. And so I do. And people send me their experiences. They're weird, but they're lovely, some of them, and wonderful and inspiring. And I hear, you know, I'll get it in Chinese and Japanese. I need to get it translated in Spanish and French, whatever. And they're telling me these wonderful stories, and they're really telling me the same thing, that we never die because we're never really born. We existed before. Our souls existed before. We will exist afterwards, too.
Devil's advocate question here.
Sure.
I don't know why I use the phrase devil's advocate. But what if the belief system of life after death was created by theologians to control us and to make us feel as if there's some hope so we are generally good and we don't go wild? And what if there's just nothing out there, Brian? Now, you don't believe it, and I don't believe it. But that's my devil's advocate question to you. What if it just ends?
Right. Well, you know, many theologians banned the concept of reincarnation because they felt without the whip of Judgment Day, people wouldn't listen. So really, that's the opposite argument. But and I can understand that, too. But so many people have had so many experiences of the other side. And people who are atheists or people who are fundamentalists, if they have this experience, it's the same thing. And there have been academics and there have been completely uneducated people. There have been farmers and there have been physicists, and they're having and describing the same experiences. So when people have the experience, it's beyond the belief. It's beyond the concept. It's not an intellectual thing. It's not a philosophical thing. They're coming back and describing, oh, the light and the beauty and the comfort and the spirits that were around and this happened and that happened and I learned this. And they're really telling me the same thing. So it doesn't come from a system that was sort of imposed on them by some religious hierarchy. It's coming really mostly from people's own experiences. And that's not taught to them. It's coming through them. They're experiencing it themselves. So that's why I think it's not just foisted upon us by theologians, that there's much more to it. And that's because people, for many, many centuries, from the beginning of humankind, have been having these same spiritual experiences. And it's really, really common to all religions and all regions and all peoples of this planet.
Brian, you've talked about soul splitting. What does that mean?
I think, you know, soul splitting means that really we're all connected. There may be one, the soul over soul that Jane Roberts wrote about, but others have written about. It explains why the number of bodies, say 6 billion or 7 billion today, where do the souls come from? Well, there's two answers. One, they can come from this sort of infinity of other dimensions, but also soul splitting, so that the soul can have more than one experience at the same time, simultaneously. Why should we project human limitations to a soul? And it just means that it's energy. We're all energy and we're all connected. And so maybe we're much more connected than we even know.
Well, maybe so. Maybe so. And when these souls come in, and like you said earlier at the outset, that maybe they might not come here right away because this is a vast universe. But what about parallel universes, Brian? What if there are many planets like this all over the place, not just in this universe? Do we have enough souls? Think about that. We'll come back to that and also talk about animals and souls on Coast to Coast AM. StreamLink, well, if you're not a member, you can sign up by going to coasttocoastam.com. And you'll take advantage of past archive programs, our iPhone app, and soon to be a digital After Dark magazine for you. We'll talk about that later on. But for StreamLink, just go to coasttocoastam.com. Animals and souls, do they have them, Brian?
I believe so. I think all beings have souls. This is that energy of consciousness, too. So animals do. And frequently when people have near-death experiences, And the same thing is true with the after-death experience. They have animals coming to greet them, pets of theirs, because that's sort of a vehicle of teaching about unconditional love. So I constantly find animals meeting us on the other side, as well as your grandmother or human figures as well. I think we all have souls.
Do animals become humans in terms of their souls at all? Does that ever cross over?
I know this is an Eastern concept, but I don't find it so much in my own work. It could be because people just don't remember lifetimes as animals, and they seem to have sort of a group soul in that sense. But it seems to me in my work that it's more common that once you're a human, you're always a human. Again, I don't want to contravene or go against any religious tradition because I don't know. Maybe if you have a lifetime as a cat or a dog or something, and as a human, you don't remember it. But once we get to the human form, it seems to me that that's where the karma has to be worked out in the human form. But animals do have souls, and we have to treat animals compassionately. They treat us compassionately and teach about unconditional love.
Well, Friday night we were talking about ghost cats, and we had some incredible stories of strange things that had happened.
Yes, absolutely.
Little paw prints on the bed with no physical cat there at all. Strange.
Yeah, they're what the Eastern, we call them sentient beings. There's a consciousness. All cats, dogs, animals, they have consciousness, and that's an energy, and they have souls. And so we're always being reunited with them, too. It's why one reason, I know it's very difficult, but not to necessarily grieve so much. You're always going to be reunited with your loved ones, human or animal.
Absolutely, and most of the time as well.
Yes.
The work of so many, including yours, of course, is so important. Is mainstream science getting involved with this anymore?
It absolutely is. There are lots of mainstream scientists who are studying this. They often are, just as I was in the beginning, afraid to go public because of their reputations or careers. It took me 5 or 6 years to write Many Lives, Many Masters after I finished with Catherine, because I was chairman of the psychiatry department here in Miami, and it was a big risk for me academically. I had tenure. It was like a guaranteed position. But I knew that the work was very important and needed to get out to a larger group than just scientific readers. And so they'll do the work. They'll come and talk to me. There are studies that are going on, but it's still not at the largest scale because of the emphasis today in psychiatry is so much on drugs and medications and the pharmaceutical companies and the money. So this is not, funded by, this is funded by spirit, not by pharmaceutical companies. So it's a little bit different intention here.
Give us one or two more stories, Brian, of your experiences with people in past lives.
One that I was thinking about telling you, it's not that long, but it's just so dramatic. I was doing this training that I do for professionals. You don't have to be one to come to the training. It's just 5 intense days. I always do this at Omega Institute in Rhinebeck, New York, and twice a year. We have about 125 people. I like to keep the group small. 5 days intensive working, and there was a man there who was not a therapist, and he was working with a partner. We did an energy exercise. She felt a burning in her abdomen, a pain, and she said, oh, this is not mine. It must be my partner's, and this man looked so sad, and he described how he has cancer, and he was getting radiation in his stomach area, so that was the burning, that was the pain. And I said, but why do you look so sad? I asked him, and he said, well, not just the cancer, but he had lost his son, he said, and he lost his wife. And we all gasped. We thought, oh, they both died. His son had indeed died as a teenager, but his wife left him after the diagnosis of cancer. And just before this energy exercise, we had done a group past life regression in which he was a Civil War soldier, and he was engaged to the woman who was his wife, who had just left him in this life, but they couldn't get married because of the war. He had gotten back to see her just before the war ended, was with her when some enemy soldiers came upon them. They shot him in the stomach, and this is, again, the stomach pain. And as he floated above his body, looking down at the scene he had just left, which is a common finding in the after-death or near-death experience, you look down and observe the scene that you were leaving, your body. He saw that she was just rocking his head, rocking him, inconsolable. She lost him. They had just shot him. And he understood at that moment that the reason she left after the diagnosis of cancer in his present life was because she could not bear to lose him again. She couldn't take it again. And so she left. And then he called her immediately at lunchtime of that day, and the relationship completely changed. It came together again in a very profound way because he was able to forgive her and understand, and then she was able to understand where her fear was coming from. And that, to me, in a psychological sense, was a very profound experience because it changed both their lives profoundly. And everybody in the room was just so moved by this whole thing because as the week progressed, we saw that he was going to be happy again and reunited again. And so that was a powerful past life memory.
How many people are messed up, Brian, because they just haven't dealt with their past lives?
I think a lot of people are suffering from symptoms that they don't have to be because they are not aware that the symptoms may stem from their past lives. I know, let's just take obesity, for example, something like that, a very physical condition with emotional roots also. So many times, I'm thinking now of a woman patient of mine who is more than 100 pounds overweight who died in the concentration camps in World War II. And in this lifetime, she was born 20 years after that. But in that life, she died of starvation in the concentration camps. And she had vowed never again that she wasn't going to let herself die of starvation. And she was keeping all this weight on unnecessarily because it didn't come from this life. When she found the root of her obesity, the weight just dropped off. And she had been gaining and losing weight on so many different diets, unsuccessful, and this time it stayed off. It's years now. And so I find this often the case. People who have died in famines or of starvation, and this has happened throughout history, of course, are often keeping the weight on now so that it doesn't happen again. It's a defensive thing that they don't need. And the other condition, sexual abuse in a past life, and the person resolves, usually the woman, not to be attractive to men, so that doesn't happen again, and they're keeping all of this weight on, but they don't need it. It's not from this life at all.
People have soulmates. They talk about them, but all of a sudden, there's a breakup. How do you break up with your soulmate, and what is a soulmate? How do you know you have a soulmate?
Well, I think a lot of times, you have a kind of recognition or a deja vu feeling when you meet a person. You seem to know them at a level that may be deeper than it should be for a brief period of time. And, you know, so I have so many stories of this. It's not always romantic. It can be, for example, mother and child or best friends or grandparent and grandchild. I remember one mother who's brought her baby just after birth, and her first words out, and the nurses confirmed this too, as she held her little daughter for the first time, were, "Oh, it's you again." She recognized her. So we have many soulmates. These are people with whom we've lived past lives. These are people with whom we're learning our lessons. Sometimes it's romantic, as I said, and sometimes it's not. Now, you can come together for a whole lifetime, or sometimes you just come together for a month or two or 6 months because that person is going to change your life. It may be a teacher, someone like that changes the course of the rest of your life. And so it's not always forever. It can be for a brief period of time or a long period of time. And sometimes, since we have free will here, you can meet a soulmate and your decisions after that, they're really free will. So let's say that you meet someone with whom you had arranged to be married before your birth, a soulmate. You've lived many times with them. You recognize them. They recognize you. It seems like you should stay together. You should be together. But your parents say, no, they're from the wrong social class or the wrong religion or something else. And you don't stay with them because your parents are influencing you so much.
Right.
That's the free will that sort of gets in the way of destiny.
But with this feeling of having a soulmate and a tie-in, a lot of it could be then misinterpretation. People who would think they have soulmates, maybe they really aren't. Is that possible?
Right. Oh, for sure. Yeah, you can really get attracted to a person. It can be chemical. It can be the person reminds you of someone from your childhood, or many, many other reasons. But when it's a soulmate, you kind of feel that. There's a sort of recognition. You can sometimes just finish their thoughts, their sentences. They feel very familiar to you. You feel more comfortable with them. There are a lot of clues. And then when you do a regression, you can find out where you were together before. You recognize them. I'm often, when I'm doing regressions and a person comes upon someone in that past life, I'm often asking them, do they seem familiar to you in any way? Do you recognize them? And they'll say, oh, it's so-and-so, or it's my mother, or it's my uncle Fred. He was my sister in that life, or whatever. And they will recognize the person. We never lose our loved ones. We keep coming back again and again. On the other side or here, we're being reunited with them.
Brian, is it safe to assume that all the people that we surround ourselves with in our day-to-day living, generally what we would call friends or colleagues, not just people you meet on the street, but friends or colleagues on a regular basis, that they were all together in past lives as well?
I think the meaningful people to you probably were. But sometimes when we do regressions, we find that not all of them are. Some are closer than others. I think we're all connected to everybody else. There is this energy that connects us all. But it's almost like an apple orchard, and you're going to recognize the apples on your tree more than the other trees, more than the other apples on the other trees, even though you're all connected through the root system and you're all in the same orchard. And the apples that are on your limb or your twig, even more so, they're going to seem even super familiar to you. So it's a matter of degree. Those with whom we've been together many times, we recognize them more quickly. And those only a few times, it may take longer. And some just seem new to us. We really don't know them or don't recognize them. But it is safe to say that the significant people in your life, you most likely have been with them before.
If people hurt other people in their life, I mean emotionally, does that mean they've done that in the past lives as well?
It may. I mean, those are the roots of these debts or karma or whatever you want to call it. That sometimes it is a pattern repeating. I see this a lot in substance abuse, alcohol or drugs, that a person has relied on them in past lives and under stress in this life will shift back, fall back to that previous pattern. And the same thing with hurts. You may have tormented a person before. You find them again, you begin the same pattern once more. But it could be that the shoe's on the other foot, that they tormented you in a past life and now you're tormenting them. So it really needs the regression to figure it out. Why are you doing this? Why do you feel this way about that person? And once you figure it out, you can let go of it. When you let go of it, there's a kind of freedom, a weight off your shoulders, because you're removing these blocks and obstacles to your inner peace and joy and happiness. You're not stuck. You're not trapped in some repeating pattern that you've been repeating for lifetimes, not of drugs, not in relationships. You're freed up, and that's really a liberating concept. You don't have to be liberated when you die. You can do it when you're still alive. You free yourself up. Then you don't care what they think. You become a little bit more immune about the judgments that others make, about their criticisms, because you feel freer, and you know that you're a soul, and souls don't have to react this way to the criticisms and judgments of others.
How important is the dream state as a vehicle to understand past lives?
A lot of dreams are actually past life memory fragments emerging in the dream. So sometimes when you dream of yourself in another time and place, that may be a past life. I had an experience myself that way. One of my early past life experiences was from a dream. I was kind of overworking and teaching one of these courses, and we were really very intense, and I probably was overdoing it and stimulating whatever memories of mine. And I had this dream where I was a Catholic priest during the Inquisition somewhere in Europe, and I was being tortured for my teachings. I was teaching about forbidden subjects like reincarnation. I could have just taught about love. That would have been enough, but I was pushing it. And I woke up, and the dream continued. It was very vivid, and it felt very real. I went down to have breakfast, and a psychiatrist who was taking my course, who turns out to be a very, very famous medium, but I didn't realize it at the time. She didn't tell me about that. And in her family, too, for generations, they have famous mediums. And she said, "You look like hell," because I didn't sleep much that night. And I said, "I had one of these dreams," and she said, "I know, I looked into it." She said, "You were a priest in Scotland. You were tortured and killed for teaching forbidden subjects." So she knew even more than me. I knew Europe. She knew Scotland. But they both, you know, we both knew I was a Catholic priest. And that came from a dream. So sometimes the dream can be very, very accurate.
Of everything that you've done with this work, Brian, is there something out there that you wish you could still accomplish that you haven't done yet?
I have a very simple goal, George, and that's just to remove fear from people as much as I can. I'm trying to disengage from particular results or outcomes. However many people, I just want to help them to not be so fearful. If I can teach them that they don't have to have these fears, that they can be freer, to heal them in that sense, to help them get rid of fear, that's what my primary goal is. So if it's 10 people or 10,000 or 10 million, it doesn't matter. As long as I'm doing that, then I'm happy. So, you know, of course, I wish I could heal people more. I wish I could be more effective, but I'm doing what I can do, and I'm satisfied with that. I don't, you know, I'm not tied to a particular outcome. I just want to help people to remove their fear. That's what causes so much pain in this world, and I think, you know, in our politicians also, and in the world, it's fear. It's not just they need more power, they need more money. Why? Because of insecurity and fear. So if I can do that, then I'm accomplishing what I came here to accomplish, I think.
If a person in a past life had a mole on his cheek, would the next person have the same thing?
That's a clue sometimes, yes. A very well-known psychiatrist who passed away a few years ago, Dr. Ian Stevenson, the chairman emeritus of psychiatry at the University of Virginia. He studied 2,000 cases of children, many of whom had birthmarks or moles or scars at the site of previous wounds from past lives. And he documented that. And it was remarkable research, very, very detailed. And he's quite obsessive in a good way about that. So, yes, it often is an indicator of where a past life wound or injury occurred.
When we come back, we'll talk about past lives. We'll take questions with Dr. Brian Weiss, and perhaps also you want to relay one of your stories of a past life, if you know it. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.